But there's still time to open the door to great prizes, but you can't win if you don't enter. You could win the grand prize, a high-definition TV from Glenn Poor's and a sofa from Carter's Furniture, or a $1,000 gift certificate from Techline, an exquisite area rug from Sweeney Brothers Rug Gallery, and more. Entries must be postmarked by September 5th. To request an entry form, call 217-333-1070.
Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering a collection of products from more than 30 third world countries, from Vietnamese ceramics and textiles to Bolivian musical instruments and international home decor.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming the Martha Graham, Batsheva, and Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Companies during a year featuring the art of movement. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Did you know the inventor of Velcro was inspired by nature? George de Mestral's inspiration, burrs that he and his dog picked up on their walks in the woods. Our guest this afternoon is writer, editor, and science reporter Peter Forbes. Forbes is the author of a new book about bio-inspiration. The Gecko's Foot, Bio-Inspiration, Engineering New Materials from Nature. The Gecko's Foot, well, it turns out the gecko have kind of a sticky foot, or they have sticky feet. We'll hear more about that in a moment. But anyway, the gecko's feet are inspiring the development of, I guess we could call it a gecko tape, a kind of Velcro for the 21st century. Bioinspiration is a new science concerned with things that are very small. Forbes tells readers in The Gecko's Foot that the mechanisms that allow plants and animals to do the things they do are so tiny that for a long time they were hidden. We couldn't see them. He says no microscope could observe them, and their chemical structures were so complex they defeated all attempts at analysis. So people were at a loss to attempt to mimic them with man-made materials. Bioinspiration and nanotechnology are changing that. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Peter Forbes. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. The Gecko's Foot, published by W.W. Norton. Peter Forbes, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Good, good. Well, the bioinspiration of the gecko leading to the development of some new adhesives based, you report, on the microstructure of this animal's foot. Tell us about this animal. What are geckos? Where do they live?
Well, geckos are a kind of lizard, really. There are a lot of species. They're mostly Asian and southern. But they have a lot of remarkable properties, but the stickiness of their feet is probably the best thing about them.
Yeah. Now, why is it that they have sticky feet but they don't get stuck? Tell us about the climbing capabilities of the gecko.
Well, they peel their feet off. You know, they have these fantastically small hairs, about a billion on the ends of their feet, little spatulas, like kind of split ends, or if you look at them under the electron microscope, they look like broccoli. Well, they're so small, these things, they get into every nook and cranny of anything they touch. But they have really nice muscles in their feet, so they kind of have like a Mexican wave action. and they push into the wall or whatever they're sticking to, and then they just relax the muscles and they can pull away again. Mm. Of course, this is the thing, when we try to copy this, we haven't only got to copy the sticky bit, we've got to be able to pull it off as well.
Yeah. So do these little spatulas, do they work like suction cups?
No, they're not. You see, for a long, long time, people wonder, how do they do it? Is it suction? Is it some kind of capillary action with water or something? And it's really quite weird because it's almost like there's nothing there at all. Everything that exists, if it's very, very small, about 2 nanometers, has a small force of attraction to everything else. But most things are very rough. If you look at a sheet of glass under a very good microscope, you'll see it isn't smooth at all. It's like a mountain range, in fact. Mm. And so most things don't really stick. If you put two plates of glass together, the area that's actually touching is very small. But with the gecko, with these very, very fine points, they can touch anything. And it's not suction. It's just a universal force, like gravity or electromagnetism, exists throughout the universe. When you get any things that are within 2 nanometers, they have this force of attraction. So if you can make things that are very tiny, like the gecko hairs, they will stick.
Mm. How small is a nanometer?
Well, a nanometer, you have to get the size. It's 1 billionth of a meter. If you go down from a meter, a thousandth is a millimeter. A thousandth of that is a micrometer, and you can just about see a micrometer with an ordinary light microscope. A thousandth from that, you get to a nanometer. So it's 1 billionth of a meter.
Yeah.
And it's almost down to the size of molecules themselves.
Yeah. Really?
It's very small.
It's very small. It's hard to imagine something that small.
It is hard to imagine, but you have to do that kind of zooming in, you know, like that the old joke of your address is your house and your street and your town and your city and your country and the earth and the universe and so on. You have to keep zooming in at different layers until you actually can see these structures. And the great thing is, of course, we've got these microscopes now, electron microscopes, that enable us to see these very fine structures.
And this idea for zooming in, the suggestion that scientists should do this zooming in, looking into the tiniest building blocks of nature, came from a physicist back in 1959.
That's right. Richard Feynman, who's a very great physicist and a great character, one of the great communicators of science. And he gave this talk wittily entitled, "There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom," by which he meant that if you can actually work at a very small scale, you could actually do a great deal. And, of course, he was really one of the founders of the idea of the microchip, because he said that you could put the Encyclopedia Britannica on a pinhead, and everybody thought that was crazy. But the miniaturization that's gone on in computing really began from that point. But you see, what Feynman said is that we know this can be done because nature already does it. DNA, all nature's most important molecules, are actually nanostructures. They work at this level.
Yeah. When and how did what Feynman proposed, going all the way down, begin to become more than an idea, more than a vision?
Well, I mean, one big thing was in about 1965, the scanning electron microscope came in. And that gave you a great leap forward into visualization. And then again, of course, once we discovered the structure of DNA in 1953, gradually we began to develop molecular techniques of genetics to understand how nature's molecules worked. And basically what they do now is they put together information. It's like piecing together a jigsaw. You get information from the pictures you see through the microscope. You get analysis of the DNA and the proteins and things. They're gradually being able to work at this level now by teasing their way in with different kinds of equipment, different kinds of experiments, till they put together a total picture of what these tiny structures in nature really are.
Hmm. Back to the gecko's foot for a moment. This idea of gecko tape, does it exist currently?
It exists experimentally, yeah, and people keep developing new kinds. I mean, only a few weeks ago, a big aerospace company in Britain developed a new kind. The trick is to make a lot of it. But, the first guy who did it, he made a little square of the stuff, and he showed how it worked by he got a Spider-Man toy and used it to stick the Spider-Man toy. I mean, this is one, apart from tape, I mean, one of the kind of exciting ideas is that you could make climbing gloves out of gecko tape. So you could actually scale a vertical building using these things. And I think a lot of teams all over the world, there's a team, well, the people who really discovered how the gecko works in Berkeley, California, they've been working on it for a few years. And people all over are trying to find ways of making these fine structures so small that they can stick. So yes, I mean, people have made small quantities of it, but the trick is to be able to make enough of it at, you know, a reasonable price, yeah, so you can actually sell this stuff.
Yeah. Well, from the walk in the woods with the dog to Velcro, it wasn't exactly a walk in the park.
No, well, Velcro is the kind of the pioneer of all this, yeah, because it happened in fact, this walk that George de Maistre took when he suddenly lit upon the idea of Velcro was sometime in the 1940s. And Velcro isn't exactly nanotechnology. I mean, you can see the hooks on Velcro. They're quite small. But in a way, it's like the zooming in thing. Velcro and the gecko mechanism are kind of similar in a sort of way. The Velcro is much, much larger in scale. But it's still a very cool idea because people for probably, well, I mean, hundreds of thousands of years must have noticed in walks that they get these burrs sticking to them, mm-hmm, burrs of the, you know, the fruits of some plants like thistles and burdock. And if you look at them closely, and you don't need a fancy microscope for this, any old microscope, they've got little hooks on the end. So what de Maistre realized was that, I mean, a burr is a sphere. But if you flattened it out, if you made a flat thing with these little hooks on, then they would stick. And, well, you know, the rest is history. We all know how good Velcro is.
Yeah, well, the inspiration came in the 1940s, but it was quite a while until we were fastening our tennis shoes with Velcro straps.
That's true. It's something I kind of point out in the book, that whenever some discover some great new... the reports always sort of say, wow, we'll soon be doing this. But it takes a long time. I mean, Velcro, once he got the idea, he didn't have any material he could make it with. And eventually Velcro was made out of nylon. But when he got the idea in the war, you couldn't get hold of nylon. It was only used by the military. And now you find these technologies, they take about 15 years or more from getting the idea to the thing becoming really well known. And once they catch on, of course, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm. I mean, even the transistor, you know, it was invented in 1948, and we didn't really find ourselves using these things until the 1960s. So a lot of the ideas in my book are, they're still experimental, and, you know, they're going to take a little while to come through. Yeah. I made a prediction in the book that on the basis of what happened before, we should be getting gecko tape around 2009. So we'll see how that one goes.
Okay. Now, 2009 rolls around, and let's say gecko tape is out there. I don't think I'm going to be buying gecko tape and scaling a building like Spider-Man. So how do you think gecko tape will be used? What's the interest in it?
Well, the great thing about it is that it's a dry adhesive, and it'll be used a lot in industry. As I say, it's an aerospace company in Britain that was very interested in it, and they can obviously see plenty of ways of using it to fasten things. I think the main use, though, people feel will probably be medical. It's very, very powerful, and it's not sticky in any way at all. So it's probably going to have medical, surgical uses. And, of course, I think it will certainly have a gimmicky sort of use, or it may not even be gimmicky. It may develop real climbing gloves, but it'll certainly be used as a demonstration in that sort of way by using climbing gloves.
Yeah. So the two-story man can now be... I don't know if you have that turn of phrase in Britain, but somebody who climbs into your second floor apartment now could go many stories higher than two floors.
There wouldn't really be any limit. I mean, obviously, you know, you can fall off anything. Nothing is perfect. I don't quite know. It'd be very interesting to see the first use of these things, certainly.
Yeah.
As I say, watch for it around about 2009.
Okay. Mark that on your calendar, 2009. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Peter Forbes, our guest this afternoon here on the program. He is the author of The Gecko's Foot, Bioinspiration, Engineering New Materials from Nature. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WYLL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. At the outset of the book, when you give readers an overview about the discussion to come, you write about a couple of other interesting organisms, a lotus, a butterfly, and spider silk. And we can talk about them in more detail as we go along, but maybe you'd give us a bit of an overview.
Well, the thing that all these have in common, as I said, is their size. They all do very different things. And the lotus leaf, the great thing about the lotus leaf is it's self-cleaning. And the strange thing is they discovered it stays very clean, not because it's smooth, as we kind of normally think, but it's actually quite rough. It's got bumps on it. Now, these bumps are not so nearly as tiny as the gecko. And the strange thing is, whereas the gecko uses its hairs to stick, the little bumps on their lotus leaf actually repel water. And the butterflies have structures on their wings that are nanostructures, and they are just about the right size to interfere with light in a very interesting way. So the overview, really, of all these things is that they have nanostructures which have these very interesting properties. They can bend light, they can repel water, they can stick things.
Yeah, and one of the things that you say in the book is shape is so important. So the shape on the lotus leaf, when we see that, it looks so different from the shape of what is on the gecko's foot, that microstructure of that particular animal's foot. All these shapes are very interesting, and that has we've can see these shapes now because thanks to the scanning electron microscope.
That's right, yes. I mean, a lot of science, people find it hard to understand the mechanism. I mean, if people talk about the atomic bomb or something, it's very hard to understand exactly what's going on. The great thing about these things is that you look at the picture under the microscope, and as Richard Feynman said, you can see how it works. And the butterfly's wing, if you look at it fine enough, it has a wonderful sort of cave structure, these caverns sculpted out of the wing cell. And it's these that bend the light. And some of them actually look like little television aerials or something. They look like, you know, little pieces of engineering. On the lotus leaf, you have these regular bumps, and the water drops just sit on the top of them. So, you know, you can actually see easily when you look at a picture of these things how they actually work, which makes them, you know, slightly unusual in science, and that, you know, there's nothing fantastically mysterious about it. It's just that until we had these microscopes, we just couldn't see what was going on.
Yeah. One of the amazing photos in the book is of the spinning tubes on a spider's spinnerets. Maybe you would describe that for us.
Well, the spider is an amazing creature. They have seven different kinds of spinneret because the spider uses silk for so many things. I mean, silk is a spider's life. It wraps its eggs in a cocoon of silk. Obviously, it catches its food from the web. But the web itself isn't all made of the same silk. If you look at a spider web, you'll see that the line at the top that it hangs from is thicker than the others. This is called dragline silk, and it's very strong. But in the center of the web, it has to be sticky to catch the insects, and that's a different kind of silk. And so these spinnerets, there are seven different kinds, which it uses for these different different kinds of silk that it wants. So when we try to copy spider silk, it's hard because there's no such thing as spider silk. There are seven different kinds of spider silk, and a spider somehow knows how to make all these different ones. So it's a very, very subtle material.
But it's very strong. How strong is it?
It's fantastically strong. I mean, because it's very light, weight for weight, it's about five times stronger in tension, that is, pulling, than steel. And nylon, in fact, is a little bit like spider silk. The chemical structure is similar. But nylon is a very simple molecule. It's the same little unit repeated over and over again, billions of times. But spider silk has got a variable structure, which gives it its interesting properties. Spider silk is a lot stronger than nylon, and it's a lot stronger than Kevlar, which is the toughest kind of thing that we make. It's used in flak jackets.
And
if we could make spider silk in large quantities, it would be a fantastic material. You know, it would be like having something that's stretchable, but it's really, really fantastically strong.
And it's also very durable.
Yes, absolutely, yes. I mean, spider silk, it's funny because people see spider webs, you know, they're here one day and gone another. And in fact, spiders eat the webs, they consume them to make new webs because they get tatty very quickly. But in fact, spider silk, there are samples of spider silk we have in museums several hundred years old. Because in fact, there was a craze in the 18th century for painting on spider silk. And, you know, these things just last. They're perfectly durable.
These paintings on spider silk, what did they look like?
The paintings, well, they're just, I mean, they're conventional paintings. What's, you know, just landscapes and things. What's interesting is that they were done on spider silk. Because the story of spider silk is that, you know, the silkworm is an ancient culture that was developed in Asia several thousand years ago, and it was been known for a long time that the spider silk is actually superior to silkworm silk in some ways. But although we learned how to farm silkworms to make silk, you can't really farm spiders, although people did try. But as we know, spiders are actually quite aggressive territorial creatures, and every attempt to farm them has really failed. But in fact, people did try. In fact, there's a story that that the Chinese were very interested in the spider silk, and they did actually manage to make a gown out of spider silk. And the story is that one was presented to Queen Victoria. I don't know what happened to this. It seems to have disappeared from view, but it's an interesting idea.
So for these paintings, spider silk was gathered together somehow and woven, and then the paint was applied?
Yes, and woven, yes. I mean, one spider can actually make an immense amount of silk. I do describe a little kitchen experiment. You can, if you want to, roll a bobbin of spider silk yourself without hurting the spider. It's not too difficult, but it's a very, very fiddly business. And what we'd like to do is to be able to, you know, make spider silk without spiders.
Once upon a time, you were quite skittish about spiders.
Sure. Like most people, yeah.
Yeah. How was it that you came around to appreciate them?
Well, one of the great things about science, I think, about knowing things, is that it can give you a new appreciation of things. I think, you know, most people who don't have any special interest in the natural world, you know, have some fear or dislike of spiders. When I started on this book, I realized I have to get a bit closer to spiders. And I started to look in the garden. We have a lot of spiders, garden spiders. And I realized that not only, I mean, the web's beautiful. I've always liked the webs. But actually, these particular spiders, the garden spiders, they have a sort of speckly appearance, and they're pretty handsome things. Obviously, people get scared of spiders because of the poisonous ones, but there are actually very, very few of those, and very few really big, unpleasant spiders. But, you know, it's a cultural thing, the fear of spiders. Nobody quite knows why it is. People have analyzed it. But once you start to get to know things, and when you learn how clever these creatures are with their seven kinds of silk, you stop being afraid of them. You know, you just find them fascinating.
Yeah, and they are fascinating, and there are very, you know, there are all the many species of spider, and they all do very incredible, they do incredible things.
They do. I mean, some even. I mean, there's one spider, the bolus spider, that it doesn't spin a web at all. It actually has this a ball of silk, which it swings like a ball and chain, and it actually uses a chemical attractant to attract insects, like moths. And when they get within reach, it swings its silken ball, which is sticky, of course, and catches the insect, which is quite an amazing kind of way, an evolution from, you know, the idea of a web that it uses the silk in this different way. So the range of abilities of spiders is quite amazing.
Hmm. You use poetry in this book. There is, for example, an excerpt from a poem written by Anne Stevenson, "The Spirit is Too Blunt an Instrument."
Sure.
Talk with us about that poem and why you wanted to include it, and then the questions that you follow up with there.
Well, I've pursued two kind of careers. I studied chemistry, science at university, but actually for a lot of my life I've worked in poetry as a poetry editor. And I wanted to put poetry in the book because for me, poetry and science are part of the same thing, part of ways of finding out about the world. I've always loved this poem, but for me it seemed very relevant because the idea that the spirit is too blunt an instrument is how does nature make all these complicated shapes? And in the poem she says, "Nothing so unskillful as human passions could have managed the intricate exacting particulars." Of course, the idea is that nature takes care of itself, really. We don't know how a baby grows from an egg, although obviously we know a lot more than we used to. And it's a poem of wonder, really, at the structures that nature produces. And obviously that was, it's so relevant to my theme, I just had to include it.
Yeah. Here in this poem, we have the wonder of an infant, and I suppose a mother's wonder at her infant. And then you follow the poem with these questions. What is nature's organizing principle? How does nature create intricate structures? That's another question that you follow up with. And where are we in terms of finding the answers to these questions? That would be my question.
Yeah. Well, the great thing that's happening now is that it's very strange that although, you know, we know a lot about the genes and DNA, we don't actually know very much about how the shape of a creature is formed. But there's a new science now which they call EvoDevo, which is an abbreviation of evolutionary developmental biology, that's starting to discover how the genes work to create the structures of creatures. They've discovered some amazing things. For instance, that some of the same genes that create say the limbs in an insect like a fly are also used in mammals like us. Now this was one of the most surprising discoveries in biology, that you would have thought that insects and mammals are very, very different creatures, mm-hmm. have evolved in very different ways, but the same genes are actually active in making shapes, and these developmental genes are now being discovered in many creatures, and we're starting to see how they actually produce the shapes that they have to make a proper working creature.
Hmm. Interesting. And this is, and here I am beginning to understand once again, or underlined for me, the idea that bioinspiration is a very broad discipline. If you can even call bioinspiration a discipline, would that be correct?
Yes. Well, yes, it is a discipline. It's an emerging science. For me, it's one of the most heartening sciences. I mean, I know some people are scared of science. They see a sort of Frankenstein element in it. But bioinspiration is... it's bringing together nature and technology. It's finding you know, new ways to make really useful things, and we're also learning so much about nature, and in doing so, we learn to respect it more. I mean, at the end, I make this point that we're all worried about the loss of species, that you know, we're losing species at a fantastic rate now. And in the past, people used to say, well, what use are most of these things anyway? I mean, geckos and flies are a nuisance, spiders, do we need all these things? But now we're seeing that, you know, what were once quite just weird creatures, or apparently useless creatures, can teach us things that are really, really useful.
Mm. And might inspire poetry as well.
Indeed, for me. I mean, it is a very poetic thing. It's when you learn so much about nature at this level, it is very inspiring.
Yeah. Now, there have been fears expressed about new materials. Are those fears founded? Should we be cautious?
Well, I try to explain in the book, bioinspiration is mostly about nature's nanotechnology, and there are some fears about nanotechnology itself. Now, a lot of nanotechnology doesn't involve bioinspiration. It's just technical materials, very small particles, mineral particles, silicon, things like that. And it's really, we're partly grown out of that miniaturization that Feynman talked about. The thing is that nanoparticles, very small particles, can be dangerous because they can go places that other larger things can't go. The things I'm talking about are not nanoparticles, they're nanostructures. I mean, we are made out of nanostructures. It's this zooming in business. If you zoom in on our bodies, you see eventually the nanostructures that make us up. Everything has got a nanostructure. If you look at wood, you'll find at that level with a microscope, you'll see it has a nanostructure. So everything in the world is nanostructured. The danger might come from new nano materials that are just like dust. You know, they're just particles that we might breathe in. What I'm mostly interested in, and certainly in this book, really, are nanostructures, where there really would not be any danger at all, because they're only nanostructures in the sense that everything around us is a nanostructure.
Mm. Peter Forbes is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of The Gecko's Foot, Bioinspiration, Engineering New Materials from Nature. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions or comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now, a caller, someone calling us from Urbana this afternoon on line one. Hi.
Hi. I've got two questions which I'd like to ask and then hang up. One is, I read recently in the Associated Press that two research centers are opening up or have opened up in the last year around this kind of bioengineering kind of thing. Bio-research kind of thing. Georgia Tech in Atlanta and University of California in Berkeley. And I was wondering if you knew anything about that. And then number two, I understand one of the things that they're trying to learn more about is that apparently fluids secreted by marine organisms have greater bonding strength than any glue we've been able to produce, and I was wondering if you knew anything about that, too. And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Okay.
Sure. Well, Berkeley has been one of the prime centers for a long time. Bob Fould's unit at Berkeley is really one of the first laboratories for bioinspiration. I don't know yet about the Atlanta one, but certainly it's a growing science. The glues, yes, they do feature in my book. The muscle is the creature. Muscles have, it's not like the gecko, which is this dry glue. Muscles, obviously, are sticky. Their glue isn't traditional sticky glue, but what it does is it sticks well underwater. And, you know, if you use a glue, the glue tube always says surfaces must be clean and dry, we find it very hard to stick things underwater. Now, we're working on muscle glue, but it's so sticky it's very hard to use, because the moment you make the stuff, it sticks. It's very hard to get it to where you want to use it. But I think they'll probably get there. The trick is to carry the glue in a form that's not quite active, and this is what the muscle does, and it changes the structure just at the last minute when it needs to use it, and this is what we need to do. People have been working on muscle glue for a long time, but it's a bit like spider silk. Both of these are that they're taking a long time. We know a bit about them, but we can't actually really crack it yet.
Mm. Where are they doing the work on muscles?
A lot of teams all over. There's a team in Holland. There was a team in New York here. And there's a team at Northwestern, I think, in the States, working on muscle glue. And I think, did they do some? Well, there must be somebody in California working on them. Usually with these subjects, you know, there's a handful of labs dotted around the world that work on it, on them. But the last stuff I heard about was at Northwestern.
Hmm. And back to Bob Full, and also one of his students is also interested now in this field, Keller Autumn, who's at Lewis and Clark in Oregon. How was it that Bob Full became interested in geckos?
How did he become interested in gecko? He was in Bob Full's laboratory in Berkeley, and then interest it really was in locomotion, and they're trying to make robots that can do all sorts of things, and they thought, well, if they could get a climbing robot, it would need some kind of grip like a gecko. But I think Autumn was working on other aspects of the gecko before he got interested in this, and in fact, he was on holiday one time and trying to get away from the gecko, and he was in I think Hawaii, and he saw a spider which he thought might look a bit dangerous on the ceiling, was starting to get worried about it, and then suddenly a gecko rushed across on the ceiling, grabbed the spider, at which point he realized that the stickiness of the feet of the gecko might be the most interesting thing. And that's when he started to really look into it and eventually track down the source of the great power of the gecko.
Oh. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Chicago on line 4. Hi.
Speaking of sticking things, I heard they're trying to explore the capacity of the fly and other insects to cling to the ceiling and other surfaces. I believe that's an ongoing attempt. And also in terms of nature, I believe the first observations of humans was when the birds were weaving their webs to create a nest for the holding of the eggs, became the follow-up for their developing bags and baskets and so forth from that point on. And to the spider, remind me of the quotation, sort of a paraphrase, what foolish web these mortals weave, something akin to that. But here in Chicago, as you quoted, there's a Northwestern University is going ahead quite large in the area of nanotechnology. So I just thought I'd offer those comments. Thank you.
Okay. Peter Forbes, you want to comment?
As I said, most nanotechnology centers aren't directly by inspiration. It's a very specialized part of nanotechnology. Pretty well every university now is investigating nanotechnology, but only a few of them are looking at the bio side. But I'm pretty sure it will increase because we're getting so close now to some of these really key mechanisms, and they have such amazing properties, things like spiders, that we're just going to have to use them.
Yeah. Also, the caller's comment about how nests might have been the inspiration for people making baskets. It seems that we've been inspired by nature all along.
Yes, it's true. I mean, before the nano interest, there are many things. I mean, the Eiffel Tower is partly based on very large trees that, of course, have very strong buttresses around the base to prevent, to stop them being blown over by wind. You could say that baskets, and birds are great weavers, so I guess people would have seen those and realized that weaving was possible. You can go back quite a long way. I mean, you think of the honeycomb is a very useful structure now that they most doors in panel doors in houses are hollow, and what they have inside is a honeycomb. Well, would we have got the idea of the honeycomb if we'd never seen a honeycomb? Well, perhaps we would, but the point is that obviously we did see the bee's honeycomb first, and we did see birds' nests. It's easy to say, bioinspiration is a new technology, and insofar as it is looking at nature's nanotechnology, it's new. But of course, we've always been inspired by nature. I mean, nature is what we grew up with, and we observe, and we use the materials that nature gives us.
Yeah, and back to poetry again. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. So let's take another on that. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. From Macbeth, I think, the tangled web we weave.
Ah, okay.
I have a question. It's probably a scientifically illiterate question, but I'm enjoying listening to you. Is there some sort of organizing principle or something in matter? Trying to frame my question, I have behind me my television, a radio, a lamp, eye drops that I'm taking for an eye problem, and it just fascinates me that matter can assume all these forms and purposes and so on and so on. I'm not sure if that's a very clear question, but I just don't understand how matter assumes so many different forms and seemingly infinitely plastic, and without somehow there being some sort of intelligence wired into matter, if that question makes sense. So I will hang up, and hopefully it's not a totally illiterate scientific question. Thank you.
Yeah, well, the ability of matter to make all the things that we use, all the things in nature and the things that we make in technology is quite amazing. But the point is that chemical structures can self-assemble into quite remarkable shapes. And there's no need to sort of look to any kind of intelligent design. People often think that only living things can create the structures they do, but if you look at certain viruses, they are living and they can reproduce, but we know the chemical structure exactly. A few years ago, they sequenced the gene of a phage, which is a small virus. They made it totally synthetically, chemically. Then they put the gene into the bacterium that it usually lives on, and it reproduced itself. So this was something that was made purely by chemical means, but it actually had the property of life because it had the correct structure. It still leaves the question of, why has the universe got this potential in matter to make all of the things that it does? And that is a very, very big question. Whatever happened in the Big Bang produced matter that just does have these amazing properties. But we know so much about it. We don't know very much about the origin. Why did it all happen in the first place? But there's no need to look for an intelligent designer.
And before we go, maybe you would talk with us about, let's go back to the lotus, and maybe you would talk with us about the lotus and active glass.
Well, the lotus actually is the most successful technology so far that it actually works. The man who discovered the lotus effect was a botanist, but he realized that the principle that keeps the lotus clean and makes the dirt roll off it could easily be applied to a technical surface. And in fact, he's a German botanist, and a German paint firm actually developed a self-cleaning paint for the exterior of houses, which has been very successful and is now being marketed in other countries. And in fact, they're making self-cleaning surfaces of many other kinds now. And you I know in America and in England there's a self-cleaning glass, which doesn't exactly use the Lotus principle, but it's partly inspired by the Lotus, that we're discovering so many better ways now of keeping things clean using nanotechnology, which is similar to that of the Lotus leaf.
And this technology might help us make sick buildings better.
Sure. The amazing thing about the self-cleaning glass is that it's usually used with the self-cleaning surface on the outside, obviously. But the material that's used actually has the capacity to absorb many pollutants from the inside of a house. So there is a possible use of this sort of technology to keep the air within buildings healthier than it is. And, you know, sick building syndrome is slightly mysterious, but, I mean, it's probably due to industrial pollutants within buildings, and this material can absorb some of them.
Yeah.
It's good. It could work in the kitchen. It can absorb cooking smells and so on.
Very interesting. Any last thought you'd like to leave us with this afternoon?
Well, really, I just suppose that the wonder of this, like the man who phoned in said, that nature or matter has got this potential to produce all these amazing shapes, and also that we're only just discovering some amazingly simple things. The lotus leaf has been known and revered in the East for thousands of years for its purity, but we only in the last 20 years discovered what's so special about it, and it's unleashed a whole new technology of self-cleaning. So there are more surprises out there than we could imagine. I mean, Keats said the poetry of Earth is never dead, and he was right.
Hmm. There we'll leave it. Peter Forbes, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Peter Forbes is the author of The Gecko's Foot, Bio-Inspiration, Engineering New Materials from Nature. The publisher is W.W. Norton. It's 1:53 Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you much, Celeste, from the Board of Trade. On this Friday afternoon, after a pretty good few days in the corn market where they managed to rally several cents, they set back just a little bit today, down between 1 and 2, 2.5 cents in the corn pit today. Futures in the wheat pit were higher. September contract up 3 today, 287.5 the high, the low at 76. Settlement price at $2, or rather at $3.78.5. They were up 3. December futures are 408 high, low at 397. Settlement price at 398.25, up 2.5. And the March wheat from Chicago, 425.5. The high, the low at 415. Settlement price at 417.5. They finished 3 higher. May futures up 3 cents at 426.5. The high price at 434. The low at 426. July contract, 439.5. The high, the low at 31.5. A settlement price at 431.75. And they finished 2.5 cents higher. Corn futures now, September contract down 2.5 cents today. 228.25 the high, the low at 223.5. Settlement price at 225. They were down 2.5. December futures, 244.75 the high, the low at 240. Settlement price at 241.75, down 2.5. And the March futures, 259.25 the high, the low at 50.